You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, my name is Tanya Pinkins, and you're listening to You Can't Say That podcast on the Broadway Podcast Network. And my guest today is a dear, dear friend, one of the most esteemed actresses, acting coaches in the business. And I'm so pleased to be speaking with her today. Her name is Alice Spivak. She is the author of the book, How to Rehearse When There's No Rehearsals. She's the founder of On the Road Repertory Theater Company. And I first met her when she was working on my first film, which was produced by Harry Belafonte and David Picker. Welcome, Alice.
Thank you, Tanya. It's so good to see you. And it's funny, I was talking about your first film.
Yeah.
Beat Street. And I wasn't absolutely sure it was your first film. So now I know.
It was my first.
I know you were a child. That I knew.
Do you talk about how many years young you are, Alice?
Sure, it's okay.
Go ahead. You tell us. How many years young are you?
How many years? I'm 84 years young.
84 years young. She has a vast history of this business of acting. And I want to talk to you about some of the people you've coached and also about the different styles and the changes in the way actors work and the changes in the way the work is. I know you have a very small internet footprint. So most of what I know about you is not found online. It's like I know you coached Diane Carroll, the late,
yes,
great Diane Carroll.
I missed her very much. My heart is broken. Actually.
How did that happen that you ended up coaching Diane?
Oh, well, that was interesting. I think the first call I got was, and I think it came through Harry Belafonte, who you mentioned, David Frost and she were an item at the time. And David Frost called up Harry and said, you know, that Diane wants to come into, is coming to town to do a movie. And she's a little, you know, do you recommend anyone? She's a bit nervous. And Harry has already told my name a few times. So there it was. He called me. We made an appointment. And I went up and visited with Miss Carroll.
Now, at this, how far into her career is Miss Carroll at this point?
Well, she was pretty far into her career. But this was a movie. This was Claudine. This was
about
a welfare mother with children that James Earl Jones had pulled together with John Berry, whom he brought in. John Berry had been blacklisted for many years and lived in Europe. And so this was bringing John Berry back home to direct this movie. And she was a bit nervous about it. Also, very, very sadly, which adds to the sadness I feel now, actually, about Diane, she was replacing Diana Sands. Whom I knew. Oh. And Diana Sands was ill with cancer. And it was sort of, she didn't know that she wasn't going to be leaving that hospital. And so Diane felt very bad about coming into town. She didn't want Diana to know she was in town or that this was being considered that she was going to replace her. Because that was something that had been worked out before James got together with Diana and got John Berry and had this lovely movie. So anyway, it's a story, I guess. When I first met Diane, Carol. I was in her apartment, and I was feeling a little bad because I knew it had to do with this sort of tragic circumstances. And she walked in the room looking absolutely, of course, beautiful and glamorous and everything. And she looked at me, and I looked at her, and then she started crying. And she said, "I don't want Diana to know." And that was our first meeting. We both sort of hugged each other, and that was started a relationship, which I suppose lasted 45 years or something.
As a friendship.
It was a friendship. She was my student. We were colleagues. We worked on projects together, but also we were very close friends. She was my very close friend. And so this was a big shock. Her passing in October was a big shock.
So she wasn't ill?
She was ill, but it was very, well, you know, years ago she had a bout with cancer, but it was very, very beginning cancer. And she had 6 weeks, I think, of radiation. I was kind of with her then. And then she was clean. She was cleaned for a lot of years. And then this popped up again, I guess, in the late summer. And I wasn't hearing back from her. And I finally had to call her daughter and say, you know, what's going on? And then I was trying to get out there. I had to go out for the convention. I was a delegate to the SAG-AFTRA convention. I said, okay, if she could just hang on, I'll be there Thursday. But no, she left the Friday before. And so I felt a little, you know, unfinished. I wanted to at least kiss her. I know that she was kind of out of it.
But yeah.
But she did. She wanted to go at the end, says her daughter, because
she was in pain.
I guess it was in pain and so forth. Mm. Yeah.
I always wish people an easy out.
Yeah. Well, hers wasn't terribly easy from what I hear from
Which kind of
Suzanne.
Cancer was it?
It breast, well, it had metastasized, is that the word? To the lungs.
Oh.
So she was having a hard time breathing. That was what gave it away. And the doctor came and said, well, let's put her in the hospital. But by then she had been kind of living a little bit reclusively. So, you know, she wasn't in a happy, happy time of her life. I don't know why this thing suddenly erupted, but it did.
So what is it like to coach the great Diane Carroll? She was already the great Diane Carroll before Claudine.
She was great. She was the diva.
Yes.
We did many projects together. A diva, though, I was thinking about it actually because of this. The divas I've known are really children. They're really little children. They're female divas. Because they've had to put on so much armor to get through. And you may even know this, Tanya. I really think you have had to do that as a female in the business and a Black female in particular. But any female, really, as you reach a certain point, you know, you realize that you have to sort of, quote, behave like a man. And that kind of makes you into a diva. But so she was difficult in some instances. I've watched it. She was difficult with me, but then she was who she was. But she was really a little girl. And that's the part that we were, you know, close about. Her being a little girl and me being also a little girl, but a little bit wiser. Why am I wiser? Because I didn't have to put up with all the crap she had to put up with, because I wasn't on that, you know, high plane. So I could be a little wiser and comfort her about things, or at least listen, hear her out about it. But she was very bright too, as you know.
Do you find that the way you coach has differed across the generations and the decades?
Yeah, well, I get probably more relaxed about it. Maybe people
you were
think,
pretty relaxed when you were coaching me.
I know you, because I love what you said about me. I'm going to have to repeat it.
Yes, I said you go and you coach with Alice, and then you just get you just sitting there, you're having a cup of tea, you're chit chatting, and then you get the job.
That and it isn't 100% true, but I love that. I love that. But yeah, no, I probably was always a bit relaxed, because to me, coaching is to try to get the best of the other person out. Mm-hmm. And if I'm sort of there as a technician only and I'm, you know, driving at technical aspects of whatever it is we're working on, the other person, I don't think my student doesn't really have a chance to come out and feel how they feel about it so that I can change how they feel about it so that they can get the job, whatever. Of course, getting the job, there's a lot of other elements like whatever's going on in the casting people at that time. So when I coach, I like to make it also an experience which will help towards all work. So if they don't get that particular job, it isn't like it all hinges on, do I get that job? It's like, this is the way you should approach this kind of thing always. You know, I'm kind of trying to always give it some level of an aspect of technique that will stay with you forever and that you could use it again, that you understand what I mean by listening and using your imagination and really embracing and communicating with whomever the reader is, no matter how bad they are. What I mean by bad is, you know, wooden they are or seeming uninvolved they are. Sometimes it's better than readers who try to involve themselves, you know, just readers who are sort of neutral sitting there. And if you're having to read with, this is all about reading with someone, what we call sides for a show, a play, a movie, or a television show, you have to create some sort of relationship with that reader so that you could really feel involved, even though they are wrong. They are the wrong gender, even, or they're the wrong age. It doesn't matter, but you have to learn how to do that. So I put all that into the coaching session. So it's not just about this one job, but hopefully it will last through some others, you know.
And do you find that applies even in this world now where we're self-taping and sometimes we're self-taping with somebody on the telephone or, you know, because we don't have a human being in the room with us to read?
Yeah, self-taping is one of the latest in the list of how to make the actor pay for his own life.
Yes, yes.
In other words, HR, I think it's called, does not exist in our industry. It's like, you have to do everything. You have to get yourself there. Or you have to self-tape. I've never done it.
80% of my auditions, probably really 90% of my auditions are self-tapes now.
Well, since I audition rarely, it's never been to self-tape. One time it was believe it or not, it was a commercial or an industrial, and my commercial agent asked me, and I said, well, I'll try, and I sent something in. But when I help with the others who I know are self-taping a lot, all because of the greed and stinginess of the people in the industry. And they don't want to, be involved with the actor. They're afraid of actors. I've taught film directing over many years too. And one of the biggest lessons is how not to be afraid of actors. They're human beings. They're just like you. They feed, they go to sleep, they bleed when you cut them. And so it's because they are petrified of actors.
Why are directors petrified of actors?
Well, if they're new directors and they haven't really worked with actors, they think the actor is going to take over because they're feeling rather insecure. And they're absolutely right. The actor will take over if the director hasn't got a clue. So they want to prove themselves, and they have to have authority, and then they cause other problems on the sets. I mean, that I've been on sets
like
where accidents occur when the director is insecure. Director's really that's another subject, because I have taught film directing at NYU at Columbia, and I also had a workshop for about 7 years, all because I was doing all this coaching on films. Like when I met you, Tanya, I was coaching. So I brought that knowledge about, and the fact that I'm an actor and that I coach and teach actors, to these film directors, in quotes, some in the, you know, graduate film school. I did have Spike as one of my students, Spike Lee. And And that was at NYU. But I also had workshops where I had people who had had Emmys already from industrials and
tell us some of the people you've coached, some of the actors, some of the directors you've coached.
Oh, dear. I always hate to go through a list. I always want to say...
Listeners want to know.
I want to say Miss Piggy. She was probably my most famous...
Miss Piggy?
Miss Piggy, because Frank was my student. Frank Oz was my student. So she was my... she's an alumna.
Okay.
Of my classes. Anyway, I did work with Frank Oz in the early days, and also a little bit later when he did a film, some years ago. So I work with directors, and I've been privileged to work with Stan Latham,
right.
and who took over that. And I was privileged to work with, if I can remember now, George, who was married to Tyne Daly. He was fun to work with. Michael Schultz was fun to work with. Michael Schultz was marvelous because I said, I've always taught directors using three elements that they have to learn, and now I'm adding a fourth. And he looked at me. I said, because I always thought that they must learn concept. They must learn communication. And they must learn, which is very difficult, perception. So concept is what do I want to make here? And then communicate is how I communicate it to the actors. And then perception is to see if the actor got it. That's one thing that they sometimes aren't really watching. But then because of Michael Schultz, I added charm.
Did he not have charm?
He had a lot of charm.
Oh.
And I said, you are making me now say charm is a really important element for directing on film.
Can you teach charm?
Well, but you can demand it in some way.
Some people just are crunchier. They just don't rub you the right way. You know, charm kind of, it is something you do. It's a verb, but, not everybody has it.
No, it's true. Not everybody will ever be perceptive either and can communicate. Look at, I won't mention.
Yeah, do mention.
Woody Allen doesn't communicate.
You've worked with Woody Allen,
oh,
yes.
Oh, yes. Oh, dear. Yes. And he doesn't communicate at all. He barely, he's hiding somewhere on the set, and he says, all right, do it again, and then he'll just cut it out. Anyway, and those were those days, and I'm sure it's still true, but so there will never be communication on that level, and he has to just keep, using actors that will fit the part and the scene, and hopefully it'll work together when the editor puts it together. And so, but there are others. Sidney Lumet, whom I worked with a lot, was a fabulous director. And I have come in contact with, but not worked with really, just sort of on the side, with Clint Eastwood, who's also still alive, 89, did a fabulous film, one of my favorites this year at 89 years old.
The Mule, right?
Richard Jewell.
Oh, Richard Jewell. Okay, okay.
If you haven't seen it, I do recommend it. It was wonderful performances, wonderful movie. And Kathy Bates, I think, has gotten a nominee for it. She sort of came out of retirement to do it, but it was beautiful. Mm. And there's Clint. And Clint on a set has charm. He certainly is perceptive without ever having to make a deal about it because he's an actor, and he can communicate through his very charming way and just says, let's try this, let's try that. And he has a concept. He comes with a concept in his mind, and that's being an artist. Mm. So I think Clint is an artist. Regardless of his supposed politics, I can't understand his politics because his movies are not at all.
They don't match his politics at all. And it's really an example of someone where the politics and the art, they don't have a lot to do with each other. He makes great movies.
Exactly. And his movies are conceptually about the opposite of his politics. He's really very left-wing in his movies.
Yeah. Yeah,
and always has been anti-war, anti-guns, and he had the first black white kiss in film
that?
The Iger sanction.
Wow,
that was Clint Eastwood.
Wow,
and he did around midnight, right? And he did about you know, the thing, many, many, many movies that Josie Wales, they were, that was anti-Vietnam. He did the un-Western Western because of the violence in it. He's the opposite of Quentin Tarantino. So Clint Eastwood is my man. And I did get to speak to him. And I mentioned to him that he and Sidney Lumet were my absolute favorite American directors since William Wyler and all those guys died. Mm. And they weren't American. Most of them were coming from other countries. But Sidney Lumet and Clint Eastwood, who started out as actors, both of them, of course, Clint went on to have a big career, and Sidney stopped it after being a child in movies. But they were similar, and in that they were love actors. Mm. They embraced the actors. They made it good for the actors. They opened up the atmosphere for the actors. And they also, you know, the actor could trust them, that they could see whether it was happening or not. Because it's very difficult for the actor who is, you know, in front of the camera to know whether that take really worked. I mean, they have some kind of judgment, but they have to rely and trust that the director who says, cut, we got it, knows what they're doing. And that's a good percentage of directors, but they do fit. So Clint Eastwood said, oh, I'm so sorry I never met Sidney Lumet. I said, I know, the two of you really are alike. They both get in under budget and on or under schedule.
Mm. Wow.
Always. Because a really good artist and one who loves what he's doing and loves what she's doing and loves the actors are always going to get in on schedule and under budget.
Mm.
And that, I see that all the time.
Mm.
Once they're insecure or they have no concept or they're afraid of actors, I consider it just fear of actors, then they're always going to go over the schedule. They're going to have to throw in more money.
Because they're not trusting that they got what they need,
they
and they're not trusting the decision,
they
so they're getting as much more and extra.
Right.
I mean, I have to say that my movie did come in on budget and on time, and
I love that.
You know, worked in a weird way with actors because I didn't have a lot of time and I didn't have a lot of money, that I'd sometimes just be like, you know, when I say action, take as much time as you need to before you come in on that line.
Right.
And then when you get to this line, take some time, you know, and just really left it up to them. And I thought, did they think that's like weird? But for me, it's like people get awards for the way they respond. You're not getting an award for talking. And it's like, my talking is not meaningful.
Right.
What you're going to do is meaningful. So I know here, I'm interested in what you do.
Right.
When you get to that line, take some time before you start again.
Exactly. Which means you have concept, I'm sure. Although I don't know the theme of the movie, communication, and certainly perception. And of course you're going to be charming. You're going to be loving even. And I think that's what it takes to really make, you know, the great. One of my other favorite directors is Mike Lee, who's in England, who takes 6 months of rehearsal.
Wow.
And creates his movies. And then he has this wonderful company of actors that they're never as good in anything else as they were in his movies, because they went to America to make some money and therefore they don't have rehearsal,
which
is what my book is about.
Right, how to rehearse when there is no rehearsal.
Right. I went to some kind of Q&A with Mike Lee. I usually don't do that, but it was his last movie was Peterborough. And I rushed over there because I just wanted to see the man. And he's into his 70s, but he's also worked in theater. He's an all-around artist, but he loves actors. He works with actors. He takes a long time with actors. They help him rewrite the script. Although he has a very solid script, he wants them to develop the character. So if you see any of his movies, you always say, my God, their acting is so unbelievable. Leslie, what's her name? I'm going to be bad with the
name. It's okay.
Yeah, in the movie... The years, and well, the last movie was Peterborough, and everybody in it, even if they were what we would call a day player, are such a totally three-dimensional character, so involved in the environment and with everything else and with the story because of the way he works. And they said, well, how do you get 6 months of rehearsal? He said, because it's in my contract. He said, if they come on later, then they have to give me 6 months.
Right.
He said, I know that in the United States you don't believe in that, of course, which is why I wrote the book. Rehearsal has become antiquated. It's like, why do we need rehearsal? Mm. Don't ask that of a ballet dancer or an opera singer or even a musician, although some of them come in and just improvise. But definitely actors don't need rehearsal. I've actually come to I had one woman, she was a lovely gal, model, and she was doing parts in television where I would maybe even go with her. I was coaching her on it, and she's really sweet. And they wanted a tall, beautiful model. Shall
Could this
I mention?
Be Marla Maples?
No, Marla. Marla,
we know
was
you
not
coach
so
Marla.
Tall.
Okay.
But this was Kathy Ireland.
Actually, okay.
And she's a doll. She's an absolute doll. But I do have to tell a story on Kathy.
Okay.
And Kathy did very well as a swimsuit model, but she also did very well with a sportswear line. So she was already doing very well in life.
Financially well, but she clearly wanted some depth.
Well, she wanted to act, yeah, some more. And so we did a couple of skits. We actually worked on Mad TV. I remember there were a couple of things that we did. And then she got cast, all right, this is a story, believe it or not, in a play. And it was Three Tall Women by Edward Albee.
Oh, my God.
And obviously it was in L.A. or San Diego, actually. So they cast her because guess what? She was tall. So she's about 6 feet tall. So,
well, that's a good reason to get an acting job.
So, right. So her manager called me up. Oh, no. And he said, they want Kathy for Three Tall Women at the San Diego Playhouse. I said, what? You know, that's a very verbal, very over-the-head play. It happens to be, I think, his one great play in many years that Edward Albee, since Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Three Tall Women, I thought, was the next great play. But and all those other plays in between were not as great as that. And so I said, well, what do they want her to do? And he said, well, they want her to do an audition, a piece of something from Edward Albee's plays. I said, well, there's nothing really in his plays for a young woman like Kathy. So I can't think of anything except Three Tall Women. And they said, well, what about Zoo Story? So this is L.A. talking.
Oh, God.
So I said, well, you know, Zoo Story is just two guys. One all alone. Oh, okay. Well, what can she take anything from? I said, listen, if she's serious about this, she wants to do it as an exercise. We'll take 12 lines or so out of Three Tall Women, out of the character, the young character, and we'll work on it over the phone, you know. So I worked with her over the phone on 12 lines or so from Three Tall Women, but they were predisposed to.
She was getting this job anyway.
So she
if she could
it.
Walk and talk, she was getting the job.
Right. But she couldn't really walk and talk, but not on stage. And I felt really bad for the other two actresses who were with her. But anyway, she's such a darling person. You couldn't dislike her. So one of the things she said to me, we'll meet and we'll work. So she was coming in to do some sort of commercial, and they sent a limo for me, and I went out to the wilds of New Jersey where she was doing it, and there was really very little time to sit and talk with her. And so I did. I said, Kathy, you realize that in this situation, unlike the ones we've done for TV, is that you have to rehearse 6 days a week, 8 hours a day. The San Diego Playhouse is underground, and you're going to have to, you have family in Santa Barbara, but you're going to have to be there and until they open, you know, the preview. And she said, what? So she said, what do you mean? If I learn the lines, do I still have to rehearse?
I I take it she didn't do the play?
She did do it.
Oh, she did.
This is what's so weird. She did. And then I was called down as an emergency during the first kind of preview. It was being directed by a, you know, some of these regional things that were directed by the stage manager of a show that was directed by somebody else. So they're kind of doing it because they have the book.
Right.
So they were just happy to have Kathy Ireland because they wouldn't get people in.
Right. Right. Come to see her.
So I did have to console the other two actresses and then go home with her. And after the first kind of preview and just give her, you know, amazing course in acting in about 4 days in her home about walking and talking, things like that. About a very acting technique one. And, right. But she won't mind my telling this because she went on to do it.
Right, she did it, and she's successful, and she keeps acting all the time.
Is she, Kathy?
I think so.
I don't think she's been doing much as an
really?
Actress.
I don't know. Beatrice is going to find out
Please
for
do,
us.
Because I'd be surprised she didn't call me if she's acting.
I feel like, have I only seen Kathy in the swimsuits and the Sports Illustrated?
Yeah, and thing? Then and a little bit on TV. I think she was even on Bill's show.
Well, isn't TV, that's acting?
Yes, but that's it.
I mean, that's acting.
But that was a while ago.
Okay.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, I don't know. You know. Maybe she got to do a Lifetime movie.
Now, what about Marla Maples? Now, we know you coached Marla for a long time.
Marla was a very... It's getting a little gossipy. Is that okay?
You can't say that, of course. Let's be gossipy.
Oh, you can't say that.
The show where you can.
I am so happy. I'm provocative, unstoppable, and fierce. Well, that's me.
This is the show where you can say that. You can't say that. The show where you can.
Again, nothing... Marla herself, why I stuck with her through a lot of stuff is because she's the sweetest, nicest person. Now, these gals are nice, and they're just not really, I would say, wise to certain things, like Kathy, who thought you didn't need to rehearse if you learned all the lines, because what did she know? But Marla came in after doing kind of beauty contests or whatever and wanted to get on daytime TV is when I met her, because the ABC, I guess it was, daytime people called and said, look, there's a gal here. We would love her to do some training because she, you know, for soap opera, and you did soap opera, you can sort of train. It's like its own genre.
Mm-hmm.
So you can kind of bring someone in who looks right, and then they can sort of get to do it in these close-ups and repeat lines over and over over many, many months, the same story is going on. So it's not that tricky, although it is hard. So I used to be the person to go-to person, I think, for soap opera, bringing in new people into soap. So they presented me with Marla Maples, and they said that she was gossipy and provocative, and me saying it, is that she was Donald Trump's lawyer's girlfriend. I said, so what? So that's why we're considering her Donald Trump's lawyer's girlfriend. So I put her in class, and she was a very sweet, could hardly be heard, but very sweet, cooperative, very friendly with everybody in the class. And about 1 week into the class, people were coming up to me saying, do you know that she has pictures of Donald Trump all over the place? And she's living at the San Moritz. I said, so what? What am I going to do about that? And that's how I started working. But Marla, again, it was sad in a way because she was divided. I mean, you know, she really wanted to be an actress. And I told her very bluntly that if you marry him, you won't be an actress because he won't permit it. Mm. And that was how it turned out. And then he decided to change wives and she was out. Mm. But there were a lot of things in between. She did get to do a few things. I remember there was a potential tour that she could have taken, I think before she had the baby and everything. It was with two actors who wanted her, who was sort of known, wanted her to do David Mamet's Speed the Plow in a tour. Mm-hmm. And she was perfect for that role. If you remember, on Broadway, the first person to play that role was Madonna. Mm. And then Felicity Huffman actually took over. But that role is about a girl who's got to have a beautiful, you know, derriere and, you know, looking sort of like someone who maybe in Hollywood for different reasons than others she says. In other words, a liar. So it was like, how do you play a liar, a beautiful blonde liar? And although I don't think she lied, there was something about Marla that you weren't sure when she would say things like, he's so spiritual, whether or not she was lying.
Maybe she believed that.
But I think she believed it. And okay. I think up to this day, she believes it.
Okay.
But she did want to write a book, she told me last time I saw her. So here's a little Trump stuff. She wanted to write a book when the campaign began. I haven't seen her since he got elected. It's so hard to say that. But she was going to write a book. And she said that he's not what people say he is, like against Mexicans, for instance, or a white nationalist. No, not at all. And I'm going to write a book to say how he really is. And I said, if you do that, he will certainly have it stopped, at least, because that would be something he wouldn't want known. He wouldn't want known that he is not a white nationalist, because he needs that to get ahead. Mm. You know, so mm-hmm. I'm kind of condensed.
It's the brand.
And so I said, so don't write your book if you don't want to get into another court battle with him, because she had been in a couple. Mm. And it's difficult to be in a court battle with him, or any battle.
Any court battle.
So that was Marla. She did get to do a little work, and she really wanted it, and she attempted it after she moved away to L.A., but he was always there preventing it. Whether or not she'd admit that, he would prevent that. It also, I really believe that it was through Marla, his second wife, that he decided he wanted to be a performer. Mm. And the whole thing with The Apprentice and everything happened after that, because he didn't want her in the limelight at all, even though he sort of helped her get into a Broadway show, Will Rogers' Follies, where she didn't have any lines, but she did cartwheels. So it was, and he gave her a big party at the Plaza, but in that party that I happened to be at, you could see that he was the star. It wasn't really a party for Marla. He was really enjoying the fact that I've got to be on camera.
Yeah, I met a cinematographer who said that there were two people who he had ever filmed in his entire career who they come to life when the camera turns on. And that first one was Gary Nolan, and the second one is 45, because I don't promote the brand by saying the name.
Don't say
that. 45 just comes to life in front of the camera. Like he's in love with it. He makes love to it. It is everything for him.
I totally agree. The first time I actually saw him was at that party, who will ride just follies. And I was standing with Marty Riches, who was the producer. And we were just amazed at this huge party that was going on.
For the girl who did the cartwheels.
Yes. One was all Western food for cowboys, and one was all Southern food for Michigan, Georgia and stuff. And a lot of famous faces were there, and I was like looking around. This was like an amazing, and the play had been playing for a while. So Marty Richards grabbed my arm and said, as he looked around, he said, "I feel like she's Eve Harrington and I'm Margot Channing." She's taken over his production. He was producer circle who had produced it. So anyway, while we were standing together in walks 45, he wasn't then 45, with a camera crew walking backwards with a sun lamp. And he walked in with a camera crew walking backwards, filming him walking in.
Okay.
Party. Everybody was there already. Marla was there and so forth.
Okay.
And it was this huge space. There were actually two huge spaces. I don't know how.
The beginning of the career. The rise.
Well, I don't think so, because I looked at Marty and I said, we were watching him. I was in my mouth was agape. I mean, I was like, that's impossible. I've never seen anything like that. And I've been around stars. I mean, I've never seen anything like that. And he and I said, you know what I think, Marty? I think that camera crew is in his house, in his apartment, and when he wakes up, it's on. And then when he gets out of the bathroom, goes to the bathroom, it's with him. And then after the bathroom, he gets dressed, it's with him. And then it takes him outdoors, and then it brings him. I think the camera is always there.
And it's just the documentary of the life. The film is being made.
He has to be recorded. And I said, that's what it looked like to me, just seeing him enter with that little camera crew.
Wow.
And then what happened inside the party, I said, Marla and I, they had been married and that she had the baby already and all of that. That's true. She was doomed. I could see it because he got up on this platform where she was supposedly being introduced and he started talking and I don't know what he was talking about, but anyway, she pushed him because it was supposed to be her party. And I went to Marty, my companion, and said, that's it. It's over. She pushed him away from the mic.
Eek.
And occasionally she would, you know, nudge him. You can't do that.
No,
he's suffering. So that was Marla, but that was just a little chapter in my life, which was exhausting because the newspapers and magazines and whatever knew my name was on her resume. So I was being hounded for about, there were two solid weeks that I was being hounded when this event happened where she confronted his first wife. So in Aspen. So, and then I was being hounded. I mean, the doorman in my building at the time was saying, what are we going to do? There's always a camera crew outside the building. And there were other really well-known people in the building. They were just so...
Yeah,
he just took
about
over
that.
And the first paper that ever called me to ask questions was the National Enquirer. And I started laughing and I said, the National Enquirer? Yeah, come on, who's joking? No, this is the National Enquirer. And they asked me a few questions. Of course, I just denied I didn't know anything. They called again a couple of days later, and they were right. Because when the Daily News and the New York Post started calling, and then even Newsweek called, and then Hard Copy arrived, and Current Events arrived, and it was like I was being inundated for 2 weeks. She was hiding out in Guatemala. She called me at one point. She said, I'm so sorry. I know what's going on. And I'm so sorry it's happening to my mother. And, you know, I thought I'd have to leave town. And they wouldn't stop hounding me about this ridiculous stuff. I mean, one time they put a mic on me on Horatio Street where I was living. And I went outside because the doorman said, could you get them out on the street? And I went outside, they put the mic, and I said, today is the day Nelson Mandela has been freed from prison after 27 years. And the interviewer looked at me, what? No, we're not talking about that. What were the scenes Marla did in your class?
I love that.
Hi, this is Tanya Pinkins, and you're listening to You Can't Say That, the show where you can on the Broadway Podcast Network. That was part one of my talk with the great acting coach, actress, director, Alice Spivak. Come back for part two and more of our dish.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.